This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. If you want a good, clear-eyed summary of the chaotic state of the world today, you should read a short article written by one of Germany's most popular politicians. I'm going to have a conversation with Trumpet writer Brad McDonald about this article. It's called Welcome to the 21st Century, and it talks about how this coming year is shaping up to be one of prophetic doom. These are the words of this politician, and how, quote, the main challenge of the coming years is likely to be managing America's declining influence. Very interesting stuff. It's amazing to hear this kind of language coming from someone of his stature. We'll talk about that first in the program. Europe should become a cashless continent. That's what some other high-profile German leaders are saying. They're saying this in order to combat terrorism and to be able to track where money is moving and so on. And some observers say that it's also to protect banks from going under in turbulent economic times. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Robert Morley about other ramifications. What happens when you give central authorities the power to shut you out of buying and selling? This is a story with some important prophetic ramifications. Last week, scientists in Britain were given permission to begin genetically modifying human embryos. They say they want to prevent miscarriages and aid fertility. Critics say this opens the door to designer babies and genetically modified humans. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Dennis Leap about this directive and its moral implications. And we'll conclude the program today with a few words about being a person of your word. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. We have a dynamite article written by a prominent German politician. And honestly, most of this article would be right at home in an edition of the Trumpet Magazine. It appeared at projectsyndicate.org. The article is called Welcome to the 21st Century. It's written by Joschka Fischer, a very popular politician in Germany. And Mr. Fischer gives a stark assessment of the dangers facing our world today. I want to share this article with you. And just to make this more interesting and awesome, I've invited Trumpet writer Brad McDonald to join the conversation from our UK office. Hello, Brad.
Hello.
We are on a Skype connection, so it's not necessarily the best quality, but the analysis will be fantastic. So let's just go
phenomenal.
Let's get started. I just want to read the first couple of paragraphs of the article here. The start of 2016 has been anything but calm, Mr. Fischer writes. Falling equity prices in China have destabilized markets worldwide. Emerging economies seem to have stalled. The price of oil has plunged, pushing petroleum producers into crisis. North Korea is flexing its nuclear muscles. And in Europe, the ongoing refugee crisis is fomenting a toxic tide of nationalism, which threatens to tear the European Union apart. Add to this Russia's neo-imperial ambitions and the threat of Islamic terrorism. And he says, comets streaking across the sky may be the only thing missing from a picture of a year shaping up to be one of prophetic doom. Where everyone looks, chaos seems to be ascendant. Pretty good assessment of the crises that are facing the world today, wouldn't you say, Mr. McDonald?
Very good and very sobering.
Yeah, I think the really everything that he listed on there, these are exactly the things that we've been watching and trying to point our readers and our listeners to in terms of the most important events, the most important trends that we see facing the world today.
Right. Most of the listeners have probably are aware of all of these issues, but Fischer putting them together in one paragraph like that, it really does kind of take your breath away a little bit.
Can you give us an idea? Just talk about Joschka Fischer a little bit. Who is this man and why should we listen to him?
Right. Well, I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of this article, not just the analysis, not just the concerns that Fischer is highlighting, but just the fact of who this man is. He's a former foreign minister of Germany. He was vice chancellor of Germany from 1998 to 2005. This is a high-ranking German official. This is a man who You know, he could pick up the telephone today and call Angela Merkel or Schäuble. He's having dinner in Berlin during the week with the power shakers of German politics. He's not a journalist. He's not an obscure analyst. This is a man who is at the center of German politics. And this is what he's thinking. Is this what Angela Merkel's thinking? Is this what they're talking about? I can't imagine that Fischer isn't sharing these views. And I can't imagine he's not having those conversations with other prominent German leaders. And to me, it just shows that the leaders in Germany, they recognize the state of the world. They recognize the times that we're headed into. And the Germans, being Germans, they surely are preparing for those times.
Yeah, let's just proceed with a few more comments here. He says, the international order forged in the fires of the 20th century seems to be disappearing, and we have not had even the faintest glimpse of what will replace it. He says, you know, we have all of these challenges facing us today, but he says, what is not clear is the context in which the response will come, if at all. In which political structures, by whose initiative, and under which rules will these questions be negotiated, or, if negotiation proves impossible, fought over? Political and economic order, particularly on a global scale, does not simply arise from peaceful consensus or an unchallenged claim by the most powerful. It has always been the result of a struggle for domination, often brutal, bloody, and long, between or among rival powers. Only through conflict are the new pillars, institutions, and players of a new order established. So he's saying we're standing right on the precipice of who knows what, and the transition from where we are to where we're going to be could really be ugly.
Right. And what is especially refreshing is that this man, I mean, that statement that you just read is informed by historical reality. Mm-hmm. War is necessary and unavoidable. That's not just an intellectual statement. That's what 2,000 years of history says. That's what the history of Europe says. When things break down like this, when there's this level of uncertainty and instability, war is inevitable. And I just think it's interesting that this very prominent German politician, this man who is at the heart of the German decision-making, recognizes that war is necessary. Now, if he recognizes that war is necessary, and if his friends in Berlin recognize that war is necessary and likely, then doesn't it make sense that they're preparing for it, that they're developing a strategy to apply when things do fall apart, as they clearly believe it will?
Right. A lot of people looking at Europe say they're not preparing themselves. They're not ready for these crises are going to overwhelm Europe. There are a lot of people that are criticizing Europe for that. But you're right. I mean, if this is the discussion happening on the highest levels, there's more happening behind the scenes than we would probably give them credit for.
Right. And Germans are famous for their thoroughness. They're famous for their planning and their foresight. If they recognize just we're heading into times of just enormous fragility and uncertainty and instability, then you can be sure that they are developing a strategy to navigate those times ahead.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're talking with UK-based trumpet writer Brad McDonald about this article, Welcome to the 21st Century, by German politician Joschka Fischer. I want to just get into, I think this is in some ways kind of the heart of his argument here in the middle of this article. He says the liberal Western order in place since the end of World War II was based on the global hegemony of the United States. He said, look, the U.S. has been right at the center of this, the only true global power. But then he says today the Pax Americana that ensured a large degree of global stability has begun to fray, most notably in the Middle East and on the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. may still be the world's strongest power, but it is no longer able or willing to play the role of the world's policeman or make the sacrifices needed to guarantee order. This is a really interesting point that he's making here, and one that we've made several times at the Trumpet. We've talked about how we are entering a post-American world that's it's going to be very different from what we have experienced to this point. We've referred to the biblical prophecy of the times of the Gentiles moving away from an Anglo-American world into a world dominated by other powers. And he's drawing attention to this in really stark terms. He says, nor are these times of turbulent transition likely to end in the emergence of a second Pax Americana. Despite America's technological dominance, there would be too much resistance by regional powers and potential counter-alliances. That statement just stuck out to me, just how much things have already changed to the point where these other powers, they're not willing to submit to an American-led order anymore.
Absolutely. China, Russia, Iran, these nations, they've become accustomed to throwing their weight around in the Middle East or in Asia. They've become accustomed to doing essentially whatever they want to do. For America to kind of have an about face and say, well, actually, China, we want you to stop taking over Africa and becoming aggressive in the South China Sea. And we're going to, I mean, China's not going to do that. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. One thing I really appreciated about that paragraph is there is an enormous amount of criticism. There's a constant stream of criticism about America's role in the past, let's say the post-World War II, the past 50, 60, 70 years. America it's been the global policeman. It's been mean to everyone. It's caused all of these world problems. It's destroyed the Middle East. It's done this, this, and this. Well, here is Joschka Fischer, the former foreign minister of Germany, and he's saying that Pax Americana has actually, to quote him, ensured a large degree of global stability. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not an uninformed man. I mean, this man understands politics. He understands everything America has accomplished, and he recognizes that without American power, and America hasn't wielded its power perfectly, of course, no nation ever does. But, you know, it's kind of refreshing to see someone who knows what he's talking about recognize that America has actually played the role of a stabilizing force in world politics, and that the world is in big, big trouble.
Right.
As it stops playing that role.
Yeah, I mean that's the heart of his argument, is that it's the end of America's playing that role that's put us in this position where we're on the precipice of something very different and far more dangerous.
Right. So, right. And you just don't hear that. You don't hear that angle discussed enough.
Yeah, I think just to put a stamp on this point, here's the next statement in this article, just a dynamite statement. In fact, the main challenge of the coming years is likely to be managing America's declining influence. This is the main challenge facing the world today. There is no framework for the retirement of a hegemon. While a dominant power can be brought down through a struggle for domination, voluntary retreat is not an option because the resulting power vacuum would endanger the stability of the entire system. Indeed, overseeing the end of Pax Americana is likely to dominate the tenure of America's next president, whoever that might be. Now, he's saying it's not an option, but the unspoken point is it's happening anyway.
Right. And in his next paragraph, he puts that observation in the context of Europe. He says, for Europe, this raises a difficult question. Will the decline of America unavoidably lead to crisis, if not conflict? Again, this fella recognizes that not talking about a future of disagreements and meetings between countries to figure out a new status quo. He says that we're headed toward major conflict. We're headed toward actual war, and not just on the fringes of the Western world in Africa and places like that, but in Europe. He says the bleak prospect of a European suicide is no longer unthinkable. What will happen if German Chancellor Angela Merkel is brought down by her refugee policy, if the United Kingdom leaves the European Union, or if the French populist Marine Le Pen captures the presidency? A plunge into the abyss is the most dangerous outcome imaginable, if not the likeliest. Mm. That's really pretty. It's pretty amazing statement.
it's interesting. He's focusing on these particular aspects, you know, these folks who are undermining Angela Merkel, these folks who are trying to get Britain to pull out of the European Union, this movement, this political movement within France. He's looking at these as being the main dangers facing Europe. But the underlying tone is we are right on the abyss, and it wouldn't take much to push us over. And you do wonder, I mean, we keep coming back to this, just these crises that are facing Europe and the fact that somebody has to stand up and propose a solution and to you know, basically establish themselves or present themselves as the answer to these problems.
Right. And someone out there, multiple people out there are probably thinking, you know, how can I be that man, or how can I support that man? Or it's impossible to recognize the extreme uncertainty and chaos and conflict that's inevitable now over the next few months and years. It's impossible to recognize that reality and not go one step further and think, what do I have to do to position my country to navigate those terrible times when they come? That's just the way a responsible leader is going to think. And as I mentioned, the Germans are not going to be caught off guard by what's coming over the next few months and years. They will have a plan. Someone will have a plan. Joschka Fischer or one of his friends, I don't know. But there will be a plan. There will be a strategy. And I'm sure it's being developed even now.
In a lot of ways, there's so much focus put on the Middle East in America's absence. America trying to vacate its position as a guarantor of stability in the Middle East. And we're seeing the vacuum, what's happening in the vacuum in Libya, in Iraq, in Syria, how ISIS is filling the void, how Iran is ascendant. In the Asian theater, we're seeing what happens as America pulls back, and we're seeing the rise of China, and we're seeing powers like, say, the Philippines and Japan trying to figure out how to accommodate the new order within Asia. We really don't focus as much attention in some ways on Europe, or generally speaking, don't. At the Trumpet, we certainly do. But to hear Joschka Fischer talking about this and really focusing on what is going to happen in Europe now that what he said, the fact that America, that has served for seven decades as a guarantor of Europe's internal liberal order, once they vacate, what happens? And we're staring at the abyss. I mean, this really does put a voice on this really pivotal prophecy that we come back to over and over and over again, that it really is Europe that we need to watch more than anywhere else. I mean, we've got to keep our eyes on all of those places, but Europe is really where it's at in terms of the next step, major step in biblical prophecy.
Right. And I suspect one of the main, let's say, geographic territories that Fischer is looking at when he makes these observations is Eastern Europe. That exact scenario has occurred or unfolded in Eastern Europe in the last few years. America has pulled out, you know, Barack Obama made the decision to not go ahead with the missile defense system. They're compromising in the face of Vladimir Putin's actions. America's pulling out of Eastern Europe, and Europe is in the position of thinking, okay, what are we going to do along our Eastern Front? America has kind of provided the money, provided the tanks, provided through NATO, provided the troops to be this defense against Russia. They have less and less of an interest in defending us. We need to do something.
Fascinating article by Joschka Fischer. Welcome to the 21st century. I'm sure we'll be writing up something about this on the Trumpet site soon. And I was right. It was a much better segment, much more interesting to have a conversation with you about this than it would have been just to talk about it myself. I appreciate your time, Brad.
Well, I appreciate that. It was good to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We are becoming a cashless society. You know those commercials where you've got all the people in line just paying for everything with a credit card, and then the guy pulls out cash to pay for something, and record scratch, everything grinds to a halt. More and more people are using plastic to make all their financial transactions. Well, this has interesting potential ramifications that we want to talk about here. We're going to focus our attention specifically on Germany and Europe and some discussion that's taking place there that could have actually significant prophetic implications. I have trumpet writer Robert Morley here to talk about this with us. Hello, Robert.
Good to be here.
So we heard this announcement in Germany from the Social Democrat Party. This is a major party. This is part of the ruling coalition in Germany about plans for limiting the use of cash, not just in Germany, but in all of Europe. Can you tell us about this?
Absolutely. So last Tuesday, the Social Democrats came out with a proposal, and what they would like to do is ban the 500 euro note from circulation, as well as cash withdrawals from banks above the limit of 5,000 euros. When they came out and did this, Germany's deputy finance minister came out and said that they're doing this because they want to stop money laundering and they want to stop terrorism within Europe. And they said that for this to be effective, Germany would really have to push for these reforms at the European level as well as within Germany itself.
Okay, so get rid of the 500 euro note. 5,000 euros, you can't have transactions bigger than that. They say that it's because of money laundering and where they're really trying to limit terrorist activity. What are the effects?
Yeah, absolutely. Europe, ever since the terrorist attacks that happened with Charlie Hebdo and then the Paris attacks, Europe is just one of the number one issues now facing Europe is terrorism. And this has frightened a lot of people. And this has pushed a lot of policymakers to really start looking for ways that they can prevent terrorism and terrorist attacks from happening in the first place. And one of the solutions that's been put forward is to embrace a cashless society, force everybody to go electronic with their transactions. And this is a trend that's already happening in many parts of Europe. This is a huge announcement for Germany, but in some places like Sweden and Denmark and Switzerland and Norway, these nations are already 80% of their transactions are already cashless.
Right, just it's a matter of convenience.
Absolutely.
But they're saying this has potentially really helpful benefits in terms of being able to track where money is going and to make sure that it's not getting into the wrong hands.
Absolutely. That's the whole goal of this program. They want transactions to be electronic so that the data can be mined, trends can be picked up and spotted, people can the movements of money can be traced, not only in real time or as close to real time as possible, but they want a database, electronic footprint of all transactions in Europe. So when potential terrorists or people of interest are identified, they can not only see what they're doing now, they want to be able to go back and search that data and look for other relationships that are now of interest to the authorities.
Okay, so it seems like a legitimate reason for doing this, but as soon as the Social Democrats came out with this announcement, there were some real cries of protest.
Politicians, especially on from the left and the right, not the centrist parties as much, but the left and the right, they're looking at this as really attacks on personal freedom, and they are very upset about this. So, for example, the Green Party, one of their lawmakers came out immediately after the Social Democrats put forth this bill and said that they called it a fundamental attack on data protection and privacy. They're saying basically what the government wants to do is record every transaction that takes place in Germany and have that available for government authorities to sift through. And they're saying this is something that Germany has never had, you know, since post-World War II. This is something that is violating privacy rights. On the other side of the spectrum, the Alternative for German Party, that's that party that's really been surging lately, it's been labeled an anti-immigration party, but they also came out and they also called it an attack on property rights of citizens. They said, quote, "If we give this up, citizens will lose an elementary right to their freedom, and the way is paved to a total surveillance of all areas of life." So there are a lot of people out there looking at this and seeing the growth of government and seeing the potential for abuses with a program like this.
It's interesting listening to these folks talking about this because this is the kind of thing that we have a lot of concern about in the United States with the growth of the NSA. And there's a certain amount of, I would think that most Americans listening to this or a lot of Americans would have a certain amount of sympathy for Europeans who are concerned about the erosion of their privacy and their personal rights and so on. But it is interesting. This is the trend. As crises increase, as the problems get worse, then this seems to be the answer that people increasingly turn to is let's put more power in the hands of bureaucrats, centralized authority. And this is Europe's tendency all along. This is the way they tend to do business, generally speaking. But this almost seems like kind of a juggernaut that is going to be hard for these protesters to stop.
Yeah, that's right. It is kind of like the first step. And then the question was, well, we surrender this much freedom this time. You know, what are we going to be asked to surrender the next time something happens and authorities have not been able to prevent terrorist attacks? There is a lot of legitimate criticism, I think, about this plan in the sense that politicians and others are asking, will they really be able to stop terrorists or will terrorists find a way around? I mean, terrorists are very resourceful. So now, you know, by getting rid of the $500 note, you know, now maybe what's to stop them from using the $100 note in a handbag, you can still stuff a million euros into like a little briefcase with the $100 note. So is that really going to be an effective tool, or are we going to be asked next to give up the $100 euro note? And this is a trend, like you said, across Europe. Banks now, countries have been passing laws limiting how much money people can take out of the banking system at certain times. Germany saying that they want to reduce it to 5,000 euros at a time. That still sounds like a lot of money. But from the Germans' perspective, I mean, they've never had any restraints on how much to Germany. This is, people in Germany, if your money's in a bank account, that's your money. You can do with it as you please. But now politicians are proposing to take away that right, a right that a lot of Germans feel is fundamental to them.
So in a way, we're looking at what can they do, really? If some of these authorities, if the politicians, if the bankers want to exert this kind of power over their personal financial transactions and that type of thing, what's to stop them from doing that? In a sense, when we use these kinds of technologies, you know, when we do most of our business on plastic, we surrender a certain amount of control over our own financial destiny. You know, we are putting our turning some power and personal privacy and that type of thing over to some of these companies. And it's interesting looking at this in light of, say, what you saw in Greece and what you're seeing in some of these European countries that are really having economic problems is governments just saying, you know what, we're taking some of your money out of your account and there's nothing that you can do about it. They have the power to do that.
They do. And this is what has led a lot of people to charge the Social Democratic Party and these people pushing these movements. They're saying, you know, yes, terrorism is a threat, but there's probably another motivation behind this movement to ban the 500 euro note and to limit cash withdrawals. And that's just the financial situation in Europe. There are a lot of banks in Europe that are, if they aren't insolvent, they're teetering on the edge of insolvency, and it wouldn't take much to push them over. And a lot of people are saying that these kind of laws are designed to force people into the financial system, to keep people out of the paper and have their money within the banking system. If you look at what's going on in Italy right now, their banks are having a slow motion run on the banks, old school, people lining up, taking their money out. And authorities are trying, they're very afraid about this, and they're working very hard to come up with ways to force people to keep their money within the system. Because if people start pulling out, you know, then you have that classic bank run, and we're back to where we were in 2008. So the movement to limit how much money you can take out, a lot of people are saying this is really an effort to prop up the banks. So, for example, if you eliminate the 500 euro note, that takes out one third of all cash in circulation in Europe. That pushes a third more of the money into the banks, into the banking system. And I think a lot of people who, you know, that don't trust the banks, that don't trust government, they're looking at this as really an attack on their rights. And they see this as a very negative development.
So in a sense, you could also look at this not just in light of terrorist threat in Europe, but also an outgrowth of the pressure on the banks and the potential for them to go under because of economic pressures and people trying to protect their investments and that type of thing. This is the powers that be basically trying to preserve the banks' power and keep them afloat, prevent runs on the bank and that type of thing. That's definitely at play here.
I think so. And if you look at the relationship it's between the big banks in Europe and politicians, it's really very similar to the relationship between Wall Street and many politicians in the United States. It's a revolving door between some of them, and very close ties. And I think when we have central bankers like Mario Draghi, the chief financial officers and presidents of the big banks in Europe making statements about how negative interest rates are needed to stimulate the economy. Negative interest rates being where instead of the bank paying you interest for their money, you pay the bank interest for the privilege of having a savings account. The European Central Bank in this past December cut interest rates further into negative territory. And as interest rates keep going further and further negative, now the question becomes, well, how do we keep people into the banks? You know, are people going to put their money on deposit in a bank when the bank's charging them 3%, 4%, 5% for the privilege of a checking account. Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of people look at that and say, no, people would yank their money from the banks. They'd find other places for it. And authorities, once again, here are trying to...
Well, here's a solution. Let's just get rid of cash.
That's right. Here's a solution. Let's get rid of cash. We'll rig it. We'll jerry-rig it this way, and we'll hopefully muddle through and find a solution.
So the other effect from this, and we tend to take something like a credit card for granted, but we are buying into a system. We're surrendering a certain amount of personal liberty in doing so, and there are ramifications to this. And looking at this situation, you could see more power concentrated in the hands of a few people at the top. And what makes this interesting for us particularly is the prophecies that you see in the Bible about just this financial economic juggernaut that is going to build in Europe, and just how much global power it has. You know, we're talking about in Revelation 17, Revelation 18, and the prophecies of this just tremendously powerful economic force in the world, but they also have control over individuals, control over individual bank accounts and individuals' ability to buy and to sell. You want to tell us about that?
Absolutely. If you, as you said, you look at Revelation 18 and you see a global financial system that really revolves around this power that's rising in Europe today. But as you said, it also, it goes from big scale. You know, the merchants of the earth, as a lot of these big corporations are termed in biblical terminology, all the way down to individuals. You look at Revelation 13 or Revelation 14, it talks about this power that's rising in Europe, controlling whether or not people have the right to buy or sell or conduct any business by their leave. If they say that you can, that's great. If they give you the authority to do that, great. But if they don't want that, they're going to have the means to revoke that and identify people who are buying and selling outside of their parameters. And so the question with this is, and what we're seeing here, what gives significance to this trend that we're seeing of going cashless and cashless society and electronic society is that, how is that state? How is that Leviathan of a state going to be able to identify those people and then also pick and choose and identify those that are breaking their laws? And they're going to be able to say, no, you cannot trade. You can, you cannot. And if everything's electronic, I mean, how easy does that become? And it becomes very easy, and it puts, as you said, a lot of power in the hands of individuals.
So we're talking about they're creating these rules, or they're trying to amass this power as a means of combating terrorism, and they could basically blacklist a terrorist and say, you cannot buy, you cannot sell. What's to stop them from doing so against some other group in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what a lot of these people, libertarians, people who are very concerned about personal property rights, and they see this trend of overbearing government. They see this trend of government is using various government organizations for political gain and political power. They see this as a very disturbing trend, and there isn't anything to stop them. That's what it gets down to. We see this time and time again throughout history. Politics are there for the politicians and for special interests, and they're very good at exploiting government to push their own personal agendas.
We will keep our eyes on this. You've written an article, or wrapping up final stages of writing an article for thetrumpet.com. We'll look forward to reading that online. You can read Robert Morley's article on this cashless society, as yet unnamed article, but look for it on thetrumpet.com. Robert, thanks for bringing this story to our attention.
Hey, it was good to be here. Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Last week, scientists in Britain were given permission to begin genetically modifying human embryos. And they are doing this in an effort to prevent miscarriages, to aid fertility, to solve diseases. But critics say that this opens the door to all kinds of ethical concerns. They're talking about this being opening the door to designer babies, genetically modified human beings. We have trumpet writer Dennis Sleep here to talk about this. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm excited to dig in to see what you have to tell us about this, what these scientists are up to. So this board said it's okay. So what are we going to expect to see, maybe even on what sort of timetable among the scientific community in Britain now?
It's quite interesting that, you know, the United Kingdom has done this. China started with this, I'm going to say early spring 2015, where they're working with this new, I guess we call DNA splitting technology. And it's really kind of interesting. It's called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R. Sounds like a breakfast cereal, but it's really an acronym for this long scientific thing, which I'm not even going to try and remember to tell you what that is. But essentially what they've done is they've studied the basic cell level of bacteria and virus. And it's kind of a unique study. And essentially what they know is bacteria will fight off a virus. And what the bacteria does is it remembers the virus. And so, especially if it survives the virus, it remembers it, and then it builds its own little, data bank about it. So when another virus comes out and maybe attacks the bacteria can actually send out DNA kind of mechanisms into this virus. They can read the DNA, and they can begin to clip out what they don't, what's going to attack them, and actually disarm it. And so what scientists have learned to do is they've actually learned to capitalize this on this, what happens within bacteria. And now they can go into, let's say, even a cancer cell, and they can begin to turn off the things and they can disarm it. Or they could go in one of the things that they've been wanting to do with this technology is to go in and take viruses out of pigs so that they can grow human organs inside pigs. Because what happens is, pigs have about 62 diseases that are not good for human beings. And so they've been actually using this process to go in and, disarm those kind of things so they could grow a human organ so that then that organ isn't rejected by the human body. But what's happening now is they want to go in now and actually work in the germ life of human beings. In other words, they want to go into work in an embryo or they want to work in a sperm cell. And this has real ethical implications because when they work at that germ level, what they're doing is they're completely changing that cell. And in other words, if they go in and they clip out, let's say that something is like a family nose, let's say that the women are predisposed to breast cancer, they could go into an embryo from that family and they can go in and they can turn off that cell or they can turn off that DNA strain inside the embryo. And so what happens then is then all future eggs from that egg or all future people from that situation, then they inherit that trait. And so this brings up a big ethical concern because you can also go in with the same process and you can turn off or turn on DNA. For example, if you don't want the child to have blue eyes, you can go in and turn off the DNA for blue eyes. Or what if you want to ensure that that child is a great athlete? You could go in and change DNA for bone structure. You could go in and change DNA for muscle structure. But it also has implications for the brain, for intellectual, for creativity. You can go in and turn things on and turn things off. And essentially, you have a lot of power to influence races and nations and peoples. And so there are a lot of scientists that say, that they used to say, well, could we do this? Now there's a lot of them are saying, should we even do this?
And the answer, is, at least in terms of this British regulatory board, is yes. Go ahead. They got the green light to be able to start doing it.
Yes, and the reason why they have that green light is you have to understand they're working with embryos that have been created, let's say, in fertility clinics. And some of these embryos, they know that when they created them, they're actually flawed. They're going to fail. They're going to eventually die anyway. For example, if some of these eggs were implanted, some of them were implanted with two sperm cells instead of just one, and so it's going to die. And so that's how they're justifying and say, well, we can go in and learn these things. We can go in and turn these things off and turn these things on. We can develop this system because these embryos are going to die anyway. Mm-hmm. And so that's how they're justifying it. And what they're saying is, well, we'll use this research for good purposes, like turning off on and off cancer cells, or turning on and off Parkinson's disease, or turning on and off some other malady, let's say even in Down's children. And so that really gets everybody all excited. But there are these other sides. It's kind of like the Frankenstein monster side that really do concern people.
Well, let's just talk about, you know, for the scientists to have the argument on their side that, hey, we could eliminate cancer, we can eliminate Down's syndrome. That's a pretty strong argument to make. And obviously, this board, they found it compelling enough that they felt, let's go ahead and do this. What are the critics saying, and how strong is their case, and what are some of the problems, and how valid are they?
The number one problem that I think a lot of, let's say, even scientists here in the United States — this is not legal in the United States to do this, by the way — but the problem is, it's really still new technology. It's so new, they don't know what the effects are. I mean, really, in essence, they're saying it, but they're not saying it, is really we're trying to play God. And, you know, what if you develop this super human that you can't even control? And so that's what they're concerned about, is, look, we really don't know what we're doing. They get all excited about the process. They know the process works. But, you know, to find out how it's really going to affect a human being, it might take 20 years. If you go in and begin to manipulate the embryo, or if you begin and manipulate the sperm cell, or if you go in and just manipulate the egg cell, you don't know what you're going to actually get until that child grows up. And so there's a real concern about that.
It's like a lot of things, I suppose, that you don't know what you don't know. You're looking at those elements of a specific problem, and you're trying to approach it with all the information that you have at your disposal. But there may be thousands of factors that you're not seeing, and science doesn't tend to think about those things as much as they do going after those elements that they know. And we were talking earlier in the program even just about something as simple as credit cards, you know, and how much you're focused on, well, this is convenient, very convenient to be able to travel around with just this piece of plastic. But there are ramifications that start to reveal themselves over time. And this is something where we're talking about life itself. And what might those ramifications be? The scientists who approved this, they're not necessarily they're not even that interested in the ethical concerns that it might have because of what they have in terms of prospects of success.
Yes. They just get excited by where they are instead of being, you know, sitting back. And that's really kind of the history of man. We get excited about what we can do without sitting down and maybe thinking for a year, well, should we do it? And then what are the ramifications of it? What are we really getting into? And one of the second concerns of the scientists or the ethical scientists, or maybe the ethics in all of this, is, can we trust human beings when they say we'll only use this for good purposes? I mean, that's a big question. I mean, even if you look at the nuclear field, and I did work for 14 years in the nuclear industry. I worked in, of course, publications, but I was around it. And here, I mean, nuclear energy is sold as a very good thing, and it does have good implications. But look at the downside of it. Look at what this world is facing. I mean, we are in an arms race. We're in an arms race in the Middle East right now. We're in an arms race between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and then, of course, North Korea. So can we really trust human minds to handle something as powerful as being able to go in and edit DNA? That's a big question.
There are absolutes morally that religion provides that science tends to throw out. And they throw them out. They throw out absolutes and look at things from a utilitarian standpoint, or, you know, is this going to be, in our judgment, the best good for the most people, something along those lines. And so they're willing to step over the lines that would be absolutely ruled out by religious considerations. What are some of the effects that can tend to have? We've talked to, you know, we know historically what happened in Nazi Germany when you had Joseph Mengele, who was doing genetic experimentation on children. And, you know, he's viewed through the eyes of history as a monster for having done something like this. today we're looking at this and we're saying, in this climate post Roe v. Wade, you know, what happens to an embryo doesn't really matter. It's not really a concern, and say it's okay to do it to an embryo or to fetal tissue or that type of thing.
Yes, I know it's unpopular. I mean, there has been a lot of advances in the study of fertility and infertility, and I know there are a lot of families out there that, you know, they went through the going to a fertility clinic, and they were able to, you know, finally have children. But even that has moral implications, especially when you read, well, sometimes they do create embryos that are eventually going to die. I mean, they've actually created life. And when an embryo, or maybe I should not say embryo, but when that egg receives two sperms, that is going to, you're hurting a life. You're not really helping a life. So there is that moral question there that a lot of people don't want to address. And the same thing is true with this new technology, is you're really playing with fire when you start going in and clicking on and clicking off DNA. You don't know essentially what you're doing, because we're not God. These things are amazing in the sense that it shows what the human mind is capable of understanding and doing. But the big question is, does mankind have the spiritual maturity or the spiritual morality to handle it? And I think that's the big question. And I think at this point in time, the answer would be no, we don't.
Well, they would look at something like Down's syndrome and say, clearly, this is a negative. You know, clearly, getting rid of this would be a fantastic victory for science. But in World War II, it was Jewishness. And it was the same kind of thinking behind both of them. And in the eyes of the ones who were making those decisions, it was obvious. It was clear. The world would be better off without Jewish people, you know. So, but at what point, where is the line between these things? If a scientist says, well, we're going to use it for good purposes, who defines what that is?
That's correct. I mean, a scientist at Nazi Germany would have seen what they wanted to accomplish was a super race, was this is a really good thing. We're going to save the world, is what they actually thought. And of course, they looked at all the problems in the world was caused by the Jews. And so man is really capable of pushing himself into areas where he doesn't belong.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Dennis Leap. He's working on an article about this subject for the April edition of the Trumpet Magazine. We're right in the beginning stages of the process working on that issue. But you can watch for this article in the weeks ahead on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate you coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me. I always enjoy it.
It's time for today's last word.
I'll do it, you say. Then the time comes to do it. What happens? Do you keep your word? When you tell your friend you'll meet him at 6 o'clock, are you ready and waiting at 6 o'clock? When you say you'll have that project ready by Wednesday morning, is it finished on Tuesday night? When you say you'll do something, do people know it's as good as done? Are you a man or woman of your word? How often do people break their word to you? They say they'll be there at 7:30 sharp or help you move your furniture, and then they say, oh, I forgot, or something came up. Sorry, dude. Often there's no explanation. There's no apology. How often have you done this? Society today simply doesn't prioritize keeping one's word, and we tend to rationalize it. Things happen, no big deal. So most of us fail to recognize just what a serious character issue breaking our word is. Orison Swett Marden wrote this in his 1916 book, Making Life a Masterpiece. Only recently, a prominent public man was criticized throughout the newspaper world as one not having enough character to keep his promises. He had not the stamina to make good when to do so proved difficult. Now that's so often the issue. You say you'll do something and then circumstances change and you realize there's inconvenience involved that you didn't anticipate. And suddenly, what you said you would do doesn't seem worth it. But think about the long-term cost of losing your credibility. Think about the high cost of developing a reputation for being unreliable. Think about the high cost of compromising your character. Marden continued, he had not the timber, the character fiber to stand up and do the thing he knew to be right and that he had promised to do. The world is full of these jellyfish people who have not lime enough in their backbone to stand erect to do the right thing. They're always stepping into the spotlight in the good intention stage, and then when the reckoning time comes, taking the line of least resistance, doing the thing which will cost the least effort or money, regardless of later consequences. They think they can be as unscrupulous about breaking promises as they were about making them. But sooner or later, fate makes us play fair or get out of the game. What does God think about this subject? Well, he keeps his word. When he says he will do something, he does it. When he gives a promise, he keeps it. We can count on him to fulfill his every word, every time. Matthew 5:18 says, not one jot or tittle of his word will pass away before all of it is fulfilled. In the Old Testament, there are laws saying that if you vow a vow, you'd better keep it. And they tell us that it's better not to say something than to say it and not do it. Don't give your word if you're not going to keep it. When you think about it, breaking your word is actually breaking the ninth commandment, which forbids bearing false witness. When you give your word and then fail to follow through, that makes you a liar. We can say all kinds of potential lies without really thinking about it. I'll do it. I'll be there. I'll pick you up. I'll bring it over. I'll help you out. Don't say those things if you don't mean it and you're not willing to do it, even if circumstances make it inconvenient to do so. When you say, I'll do it, you're signing your name to the contract and committing your reputation and your character. Just a few decades ago, many, if not most, significant business transactions were sealed with a man's word and his handshake. No forms, no lawyers, no contracts. The man saying it was the contract. Modern society has gotten further and further from lives of honesty, uprightness, integrity, truth, trustworthiness. Now, agreements have to be bound by carefully worded, signed, notarized contracts because people can't be trusted to keep their word. If everyone struggled and fought to keep his word, no matter the obstacles, we wouldn't need contracts and lawyers. This issue of reliability, of keeping your word, it touches everything. Christ says, every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. In his 1856 inaugural address at the University of Glasgow, Scotland, Lord Bulwer Lytton said, a man is already of consequence in the world when it is known that we can implicitly rely upon him. I have frequently seen in life a person preferred to a long list of applicants for some important charge, which lifts him at once into station and fortune merely because he has this reputation, that when he says he knows a thing, he knows it, and when he says he will do a thing, he will do it. What is your reputation? Keeping your word should be as important as keeping the Ten Commandments, because it is keeping the Ten Commandments. It is actually the love of God. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. If you like the analysis you hear on this program, then we want to give you a subscription to the Trumpet Magazine. The voices you hear on this program are the writers of this exceptional monthly news magazine. To receive the Trumpet every month for free, go online to thetrumpet.com. We also have articles posted there every day, reporting and analyzing the events of the day and how they fulfill the prophecies of the Bible. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brad McDonald, Robert Morley, and Dennis Leap. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Henry Miller. The moment one gives close attention to anything, even a blade of grass, it becomes a mysterious, awesome, indescribably magnificent world in itself. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been- been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.